Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the literary world. My guest today is author Philip Davidson. Philip has just released an interesting action-adventure novel called Dreamer. Good morning, Philip, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Let me begin by asking you, do you go by Philip or Phil?
I go by Phil.
Okay, well, Phil it is then. That's what we'll call you. Maybe we can start with a little background. Who is Phil Davidson?
Well, I'm presently a practicing attorney in Nashville. I have had a rather long career. I'm not the young whippersnapper anymore, but I was a former soldier and a former police officer. I've been a college professor and a coach, and now I'm still practicing law.
You have been around the block, in other words.
I have. I've been very lucky to have a very background experience.
What do you specialize in any particular aspect of the law?
I do mainly civil rights work.
Oh, how interesting.
It is an interesting line of law.
Right. Is Dreamer your first foray into the book world? And where did the idea for the plot come from?
Actually, in 1979, I wrote a textbook called SWAT, and that book was picked up and used by police departments all across the country. It was the first book on SWAT tactics ever published, and it actually was used by the Department of Defense in training what they called Blue Light, that eventually evolved into Delta Force. If you read Beckwith's account of the attack into Iran, he has some passages that he quotes and talks about training. But that was a long time ago.
Okay. Some of the... I found Dreamer to be a really, really intriguing novel. I'm a professional reader, if you will. I read so many books, you know, way more than the average person. And I found Dreamer to be a multi-layered piece of writing. Three layers in particular stand out. You have the Vietnam flashbacks, some of which are pretty graphic. Now, you yourself are a Vietnam vet, I understand.
That's correct.
It was a brutal conflict, and I'm guessing that some of the flashback-type material that you use is based loosely on your own experiences while in the country?
That's I'd be untruthful if I said that wasn't true. I cannot talk about, and I'm not trying to be dramatic or anything like that, I cannot talk about some of the things that I was involved in, but I did command a night ambush team in the Delta. The team was made up of Kit Carson scouts, which are ex-Viet Cong that had come over to the government. It was half Cambodian, half Vietnamese. I had a Cambodian, Vietnamese, and Chinese interpreter, and there were a couple other Americans. And that was the unit I commanded in Vietnam.
Wow. A question that I like to ask people that were involved in that conflict is, when you returned home, it was not to a hero's welcome. Many people shunned the soldiers, and yet the soldiers themselves, many of them didn't choose to enter that conflict.
No, that was a draft a draft war. Now, as an officer, I was a young 25-year-old infantry captain. I volunteered, of course. I didn't really have that experience because I was very dedicated to the mission that I had over there. And when I came back, I went straight to Alaska at the Northern Warfare School before I got out of the Army and there to law school. But a lot of the soldiers did. In fact, I was on President Reagan's Vietnam Leadership Committee where we started first studying the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Boy, you have been around the block.
Well, I'm an old guy. I'm 63. I don't feel old, but chronologically, I am, I guess.
Right. The second plot line in the novel concerns Argentina, and I found that fascinating. Like, everyone has heard of the Falklands War. You know, it's just one of those things that everyone knows about. Yet, far fewer people have heard about what was effectively an internal war within the country itself in the second half of the 1970s and into the first half of the 1980s. Some estimates go as high as there being 30,000 people who were abducted, tortured, and killed for being dissidents against the military junta.
Yeah, I became fascinated with the Falklands War at the time that the Falklands War was going on. I was an armor officer in the Tennessee National Guard, and it was an operations officer for an M1 armor battalion. Well, no, it wasn't M1. We were 60s back then. We eventually went to M1s. But the character Alvarez is actually patterned off of the actual individual who commanded the unit, which I don't give it the same name that it had in Argentina. But this guy was actually captured by the British. They didn't realize who they had and let him go. But this unit did exist. It did do its deadly work. And I thought it would be, in the book, would be a good vehicle to sort of pit the main character and all of his people up against. They knew they were going to eventually have to face this guy at some point.
Yeah, I really like that, and as I said, it's a subject that is so rarely talked about, which is surprising.
Well, it's certainly talked about in Argentina, and one of the things I was hoping with this book that it would be read in England and read in South America, because it's pretty historically accurate on how it evolved and what actually happened. There was a lot of innocent people who were murdered, and I think the Argentinian people today are understanding this and trying to come to grips with it. But I thought that it would be a good vehicle, like I say. If you notice through the book, there's a lot of chapters where you just simply switch to action in the Falklands War, and they're fighting, and then you move to something else. It sort of gives you a backdrop to let the reader know, okay, we're traveling down Central America, but at the same time, all this is going on 3,000 miles away, and this is what these guys are slowly approaching. I wanted to kind of give the reader a sense of the timetable that they were facing once they made the decision to rescue Sonny.
Do you yourself have any connections with Argentina?
No, I do not. I did study this quite a bit, and I wanted to make sure that I was as historically and timeline as accurately as I could be in the book.
Right. Then we move on to the third plot line that just quietly exists in the background, but it's there. The classic good versus evil, God versus Satan. Why did you bring this theme to the party?
Well, I've always felt, and this is going to cause people to, I think, wince a little bit, but I don't think so. If you read the Old Testament, I've always felt that God was a warrior. Despite what we've been told, I think that God was a warrior. He certainly spent a lot of time with warriors, which usually people spend time with people they like. I felt like that in this particular case that God had a plan to save these warriors whose lives had entered into what I call a darkness after Vietnam. They had a horrible experience, which I describe in some graphic detail in the book, and what happened to him and how he comes to them in the form of an individual that they know and then plants the seeds for them to make a choice themselves as to what they're going to do. Are they going to stay the way they are, or are they going to move toward another direction where only warriors move? Average people don't move in these directions, you know, and he brings them together. But then again, a religious philosophy I have, because the scriptures say that Satan has been given the earth is his. Satan has a duty. That's going to cause some problems too. Satan has a duty to try to stop good things. That's what God charged him with doing, in my opinion. And of course, Satan comes in the exact same form as God does and tries to do this. In fact, in the book, when David wrestles with God, he doesn't know he's wrestling with God, but he does on the shores in Georgia. And then when he meets Satan, you know, in the dark of the night, and Satan tries to convince him at the last moment not to carry out this mission, to stop and go home. I felt like those were things that the average person could grasp and say, look, how's this happening in my life? How's God trying to influence me, and how's Satan trying to stop me? Where do I go? Do I take a step forward? Do I take a step back? And that was the purpose in that.
I thought it was very, very clever, and I enjoyed the book a great deal. The three separate yet intertwined themes give the story a huge amount of depth if you go looking, or if you're just looking for a great, you know, action thriller, escapism read, you can take it at that level. Was this a conscious decision, or just something that, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into it?
No, I think you're exactly right, and I have an appreciation for you recognizing that. What I wanted to do was reach several groups of people. I wanted to reach, first of all, I wanted to reach people who shared a belief in God. And this doesn't necessarily mean Christian. It can mean Jewish, which I have a lot of close friends of mine that are Jewish, and I've talked with them about their concept of this. It could be Hindu. It could be anyone. This is not a Christian novel, though Christians could relate to it, because certainly one of the characters here who becomes redeemed, so to speak, is a Catholic priest. He doesn't become redeemed to the last page of the book. You know, it's what he fights and what he goes through, how they're all affected, and how, you know, Vietnam took away their all of them's sense of proportion and sense of rightness. But that was my purpose plan. Then if you didn't want to go to that level, if you just wanted to watch Argentine and naval aviators fly at each other at 2,000 miles an hour and try to shoot each other down, or you wanted to learn, you wanted to see how CM-19 operated in Colombia, you know, and how they almost the team almost got killed by them. If you wanted to, there's a historical then there about the Contras and Eden Pastor, who's an actual real figure. All these things were there for you, and then, you know, so you could go whatever level you want. There's a scene where David's dreaming and he's in a cockpit of an airplane. He doesn't know he's that for a while, and the things that God says to him there about this darkness that's coming over the earth, that could mean anything to anybody. It could mean whatever today. It could mean how you feel about things in government, or it could mean how you could feel about the creeping atheism that's going through the land. So these are my purposes, to get the reader to think, and many different readers and many different interests.
And I think you've done an absolutely fabulous job. Do you plan a sequel of some kind?
The
reason I ask that is you've created some very well-defined characters, and it seems such a waste not to reuse them.
I understand, and I might do that. I've actually thought about it, to be honest with you. I have been working on another novel called Rebel, and it's the reader will have to determine who the rebel is, of course, but But it takes place in Tennessee in a small county. As you know, we have more football players and country music stars living in one county next to Nashville than anywhere in the world. And it takes place in that county, and it involves a terrorist group. It's called the Sons of Liberty, which a long time ago I used to teach a class called terrorism in college before terrorism became in vogue. This was like the late 70s, early 80s, and we used to study the mind of a terrorist. And so there's a local – anyway, I don't want to get into all that, but what I'm saying, I've thought about it. I have, because these are interesting characters. Some of them, you know, they're just left there. You don't know what happens to them after that. And I'm glad that a person is interested and say, well, what happens to these people now? You know, because there are some stuff that just left there. The Falklands War is coming to an end. We know where the priest, we know where Perez is. We know, we don't know if Alvarez is dead. We know that things happen. So, you know, that's an interesting concept.
Yeah, I think it might be worth, you know, giving some thought to. I see a definite opportunity. This new book, Rebel. When are you expecting to go to print with it?
Oh, it's several months away. It's not the easiest thing to write a book, and you know, if you put a lot of time into it, you know, it's going to take a little while. I hope to have it ready to go next year.
Right. I have a friend who is an author. He's an ex-FBI guy by the name of Terry Turchi, and he was actually the lead investigator and his co-author, whose name escapes me right now, was his lead profiler, looking for Kaczynski, the Unabomber.
Unabomber.
Yeah, and he also led the hunt for Eric Rudolph for a year.
Olympic bomber.
Right, yeah. I think you two would probably get along just fine. Do you have an internet site?
I do. This book is on a website called DreamerNovelTalk.com. DreamerNovelTalk.com. A person can order the book there, or they can chat with me there and talk with me, and I'll certainly be glad to talk with them about it. I have gotten some pretty bad criticism about this book, not because of the way it's written or anything, simply because some people wanted this to be a Christian novel, and they didn't like the obvious cursing, the sex which is in it, which, by the way, is between a married couple, and violence. There's a lot of violence. And So whether you like it or dislike it, I'll be glad to talk with you about it.
Actually, I found that interesting. We were talking before we went on air. As a reviewer, I make an absolute point of not reading anyone else's review on a book until I have published mine. I don't want my review to be colored by other people's ideas and judgments, and I also find it fascinating to, you know, read what other people think, and you know, sometimes I sit back and I go, huh, were we reading the same book?
Well, it's like art. My youngest daughter's a graphic artist, and you know, we were talking about this. She read one of the reviews where a reviewer just really went all over me about the sex and violence. And, you know, she said, Dad, when I draw something, no two people are going to look at it the same way. No, they're going to see something differently in it. And that's because we're just different human beings. And so I don't have a problem with that.
You see, where I kind of became confused reading some of these other reviews was the fact that they kept pushing this Christian aspect.
Yeah.
And I don't really... yes, it's there in the book, but it's not really the main theme, or it doesn't have to be the main theme.
No, it doesn't. You know, I happen to be a Christian, and I'm a Catholic, and that's why I put the priest in there. I was kind of concerned. I mean, I want Christians to read this because I think Christians will find the source they're looking for there, to understand, you know, these men and what they went through and how they changed. Especially Sonny, the girl who the wife who's captured. I mean, she's not just in this just one time. She's in this book several chapters, and of course there's this one chapter where she's tortured, and I know that upsets some reviewers, but. She, you know, people are tortured, and they were tortured at this place, and I had to let the reader know what was going on with her. But I hope Christian readers will like this book if they will just try to get past the fact that I'm not speaking to any one theology.
Right. So the feedback you're getting is a little bit of a mixed bag.
I've had actually some very good reviews from Christian reviewers. Two of them especially that they really liked the book and said, you know, look, the curse words, the violence, the sex makes it seem more real. And I think that was to me was a very good compliment.
Right. The publishing industry is a tough one.
It is.
What are you doing to actively market the book? Are you doing book signings?
No, I haven't done any book signings. What I've done is published this book through iUniverse, and then, of course, sent it out for copies for people to review, hoping that some publisher would decide that this is a good book that they should publish it. There's been many cases where this has happened in the past, and it's because it's very difficult with so many people writing books to get someone to read your work, and most won't even read it. And so this is my I don't want to say chance, because I mean, but this is certainly the avenue I've used to try to advertise the book, and that is to self-publish it. iUniverse has done a good job of that, and then to send it out to people like you and other readers, and hopefully the readers will pick it up, and somewhere along the line somebody will say, hey, you know, this book should really be published, and it should be distributed on a larger scale.
In fact, let's talk the nits and grits of the publishing industry for a second.
Okay.
Dreamers on the iUniverse imprint, POD, as we print on demand, as we call it in the trade. Did you try the traditional avenues first?
Yes, I did. I sent it out to a synopsis, and a cover letter, all the things that the manuals and books say you're supposed to do, and nobody bid it. I mean, this is not unusual. You know, Ernest Hemingway was turned down 93 times. J.K. Rowling was turned down some 80 sometimes. Nobody would publish her book. This is just the norm. It's not an exception. And so what happens is, if you're a writer, you hope that just one person, one individual that likes this and says, you know, this is where I want to go with it, because this is such a subjective industry. But it just takes one person. The guy who wrote The Shack, he couldn't get anybody to publish his book. He published it, self-published it, and it sold a lot of books, and some publisher noticed it and said, hey, you know, this is something we want to look at. And that's what I'm hoping happens to Dreamer.
Right. In fact, another well-known author, Tom Clancy,
yes,
he hawked The Hunt for Red October around every known publisher for two years. You know, before he could get anyone to.
And then the people that looked at it was the Naval Press, which was like a local college press saying, let's publish this book. And they had reluctance to do it. And then after they published it, somebody picked it up. I think Dreamer, and of course, it's hard for me to be subjective, But I think Dreamer is a great book. I think it has a lot of meaning to it, a lot of action, a lot of interest. I think it would make a, if I don't, pardon me saying this, I think it would make a great movie.
It would.
And, you know, there's a lot of things going on here. There's a lot of biblical stuff that goes on here. Stuff, you know, David, the character for David is David, the Old Testament David.
Right.
The character of the team, I knew every one of those people, but I just give them different names. You know, but that's what I hope to do. And I mean, all you can do is do the best you can and try everything you can. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't. But you know, it is I publish, and I hope a lot of people will read it. You know, a lot of guys like you that are bloggers. You reach a huge audience, and maybe one of the readers listening to this will be interested in the book.
Oh, I'm sure that there'll be more than one reader interested in it. And you know, I will second what you said. It is a great book. I thought it was incredibly well done, and that's something that occasionally doesn't happen in the print-on-demand world. Clearly, you did go through all of the proper steps. I mean, I didn't find typos and grammatical problems. You must have a pretty strong team behind you.
Well, I had a lady who asked, you know, had to retype this as many times, obviously, and she would make a lot of good suggestions, and I think I even talk about her. Her name is Diane Gaynor in the book. So, yes, I mean, any writer has to depend on people to help him edit a book.
Right. I see print-on-demand as a bit of a double-edged sword. In fact, I was talking to an author yesterday. This guy has written something like 35 books, all on major imprints, but they're all technical books. He is an educator by trade and teaches in a college. He went out and produced a children's book, but no traditional publisher would talk to him. I mean, they wouldn't even give him the time of day. He couldn't find an agent.
Yeah.
In fact, no agent would even have the courtesy to write back and say thanks, but no thanks. Yeah, brutal, brutal stuff.
It is. It's a tough. It's tough to break into. That's why I haven't given my day job up. I mean, it's tough. But you know, again, it just takes one person. It took one person to think J.K. Rowling's book about a child wizard, was worth publishing. So that's what I'm saying. It's a very subjective profession. But you know, again, there was a great article in Time a few months back about the iPublishing world, and not necessarily iUniverse, but the publishing cyberspace. That people really will use this as an avenue. For instance, this book's on an ebook for $6. I mean, you know, and people will reach this more than they will, in many instances, going to a bookstore. And so I'm happy with the experience I've had with iUniverse, and I think that hopefully there will be people that will buy the book, and it may catch a regular publisher's interest.
Right. Actually, it might be iUniverse that that Gary used. What he was saying was that the problem he faces now is distribution. Without that sort of traditional publishing house behind you, you have a real uphill battle to get the book on the store shelves.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. And you know, again, but hopefully people, you know, we'll go to the website, and there's just an easy way to order it. You know, bam, you just pop it, and they send you a book, you know. And a lot of people, you know, in the past have ordered movies that way. There's a whole industry built up around that. And I'm not saying this is what will happen here, but, again, it's a way to get the book out to people and word by mouth. And at some point, somebody may notice, hey, look, this book is selling. It's on the internet. People are reading it. There's been some good reviews in it, and hopefully, somebody will notice it.
I'll give you a couple of really horrible statistics. just to explain what an uphill battle an author has. Mm-hmm. The Boca Company, who administered the world of ISBNs, claimed that in 2008, 300,000 new titles were released in the U.S. alone. That's an awful lot of books.
Yep.
Now, a press release they put out about a month ago was actually the result of a poll, and it claimed that in the age group 13 to, I think it was age 60, only 45% of respondents had read a book in 2008. Now, if you consider that most 13 to 17-year-olds absolutely have read books because they're in school and it's part of the curriculum, that means that there's a horribly small percentage of adults that reach for the printed word anymore.
Well, I think that's true, and a lot of it has to do with the internet. A lot of it has to do with TV, access to other forms of entertainment. But there's still a lot to do, and obviously those people that do read are the ones I'm trying to reach. And a lot of times people read things by word of mouth. Somebody will say, you ought to read this, and I realize the statistics are like a wave out there, but you just it's got to try to stay upright when it hits you.
Right. There are basically two types of writers. There's the people that will carve out some time every day and set themselves a goal of 1,000 words or 2,000 words or whatever. And there's another group of writers that write when the fancy takes them. Which group do you belong to?
I'm the former. I try to write every day. I try to put something together every day. It took me about 5 years to write this book. It was not an overnight thing to me. It's been revised many, many times. I'm a little more clearer about what I'm doing with what I'm doing now. It still has a lot of complication. There are a lot of plots, a lot of different characters, a lot of different things. It's more set in a modern time than this one was. But I try to write every day.
Most writers are also readers. Who are your favorite authors?
Well, my problem with that is that in my job, people don't understand about lawyers, I don't think. We mostly read and write all day.
Right.
I'm seriously. If we're not trying a case, we're reading or writing. And I haven't really read anything. I think the last book that I actually read was by McCollum, 1770. What was it? It was about the George Washington and the Battle of New York. It was a historical. It wasn't a novel. But I just don't have the time to read, because that's all I do during the day is read and write, and then if I'm going to write something at night, I've got to spend the time doing that. Before I started writing, I read all of Leon Uris, all of his books. I've read I read a lot of novels. I read everything that Ian Fleming wrote, and people don't realize what a great writer Ian Fleming was. They've seen too many of the James Bond movies. If you really want to see something great, read a book of his. I've read a lot of Solzhenitsyn. I've read all of his books, The Cancer Ward, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich.
I've slogged my way through all of those.
Well, I actually enjoyed them.
Oh my goodness!
I actually enjoyed it. I was stationed in Berlin before I went to Vietnam. I did a lot of reading over there because it was had a lot of time on my hands. We didn't do a lot of training in Berlin, but of course that was during when the Cold War was going on. The wall was there, and the Vopos and people trying to escape. It was a And I actually in 1969 I was the U.S. officer for Spandau in December of 69, which was where Rudolf Hess was kept, and I was actually locked up with 44 other soldiers in there when I was a young second lieutenant guarding Rudolf Hess. So had a lot of time to read.
Right. Actually, Solzhenitsyn, the only book I think I can genuinely say I really enjoyed was A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich.
It was a great book. It was a great book. I read that. And, of course, I thought August 1918 was very good because it was, of course, it was a war book, really.
Right. Alas, our time is up.
Okay.
But I really want to thank you for taking time to come on the show today. It's been a very interesting conversation, and just give our readers one more schwack at your website they can order copies.
Yeah, it's www.dreamernoveltalk.com. That's all one word. .com.
Phil, it's been wonderful, and I do wish you every success with Dreamer, and I'm looking forward to Rebel. You remember to contact me when when Rebel's ready to rock and roll.
Thanks a lot.
This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News, wishing everyone a wonderful day, and I'm sure we will be talking to you all again soon. Goodbye.